Macmillan Audio presents The Immortality Key, The Secret History of the Religion with No Name, written and read by Brian C. Murescu. Foreword written and read by Graham Hancock.
Foreword. Like Brian C. Murescu, author of the excellent Immortality Key that it is my pleasure to introduce to you here, I was raised in a Christian household. My family was Presbyterian, whereas Brian's upbringing was Roman Catholic. There are many doctrinal differences between these two denominations, but both practice the rite of Holy Communion, and until as late as the 18th century, both advocated and pursued horrific deaths by burning at the stake for heretics, particularly those accused of witchcraft. My mother and father met in church in Edinburgh in the 1940s, and my father went on to qualify as a surgeon, subsequently taking up a post as a medical missionary at the Christian Medical College in Vellore, in the south of India, which he held from 1954 until 1958. Born in 1950, I was my parents' only child, and our 4 years in the mission field, embedded in a devout Christian community, were undoubtedly formative in my life, although certainly not in the way that my father in particular had hoped. His efforts to fill my head with Christian ideas, buttressed by regular readings from the Old and New Testaments, only fueled my growing dislike of attending church and being forced to listen to long, boring sermons. By the time I was 14, that feeling of dislike had crystallized into detestation. The year was 1964. I'd been back in Britain for 6 years, and I was having a miserable time at a boarding school in the city of Durham. Affiliated to the Church of England, which has its own doctrinal differences from Catholicism and Presbyterianism, but with both of which it shares the rite of Holy Communion, that school, at that time, was horrible and sadistically violent in ways I won't even begin to describe here, and was overlooked by a chilly stone chapel where regular services were held, services that we, as pupils, were required to attend. I remember actively dreading those services for being so remorselessly boring and actively resenting them for their stupidity and irrationality. Why should I believe in this God and in his Son, Jesus, and why should I believe in heaven and hell, angels and Satan, just because the Bible, ministers of the church, and my parents told me that these things were real? They weren't real to me. Expressing my rebellion in my teenage way by refusing to kneel, pray, or sing hymns during chapel services, I determined that henceforth I would question everything and never again take anything on trust just because some authority figure or some musty book said it was so. By my late teens, I was already a committed atheist. Indeed, atheism seemed to me to be the only reasonable and rational position to hold in response to Christian dogma. Then, in the early 1970s, I attended university, where I studied sociology, at that time a radical and questioning discipline, and my views hardened further. I've stayed an atheist ever since, in the strict sense of the word, which derives from the Greek atheos and means literally godless. 50 years have gone by, and I still see no reason to believe in a deity or deities of any kind. Nevertheless, certain experiences that have come my way during this past half century have changed my outlook profoundly, and while God remains an unproven hypothesis, the experiences I speak of have persuaded me of the existence of realms and realities other than our own that coexist with ours and exert influence upon every one of us, but that largely go unseen and unrecognized in modern technological societies, particularly those that have suffered long exposure to Christian teachings. Experiences. If I listen to a sermon in church, the experience I have there, almost needless to say, is the experience of listening to a sermon in church, plus the experience of whatever reactions the sermon evokes in me. The experience, in this case, therefore, is akin to the experience of listening or reacting to a lecture or to any other kind of teaching. I may learn something new, or I may be confronted by material that I'm already familiar with, and I may react with any of a broad range of emotions, from crushing boredom at one end of the scale to enthusiastic engagement at the other, and with varying degrees of agreement or disagreement with what the speaker is saying. Likewise, if I listen to a lecture or read a book or academic paper on the Human Sex Act, I may experience the lecture or book or paper as boring or stimulating or intriguing or disconcerting or informative or redundant, etc. One thing is for sure, however, hearing the lecture or reading the book or paper is categorically not the same as the experience I would enjoy if I were actually having sex. We can hopefully agree, therefore, that as experiences, teachings, sermons, books, lectures, and papers are separate, distinctly different from, and of a lower order than whatever it is they seek to describe, analyze, or elucidate. Just as to hear a lecture on sex is not the same as having sex, so to hear a sermon on the kingdom of heaven is not the same as visiting the kingdom of heaven and experiencing it directly. Which brings me to the subject of psychedelics and the experiences they unleash. My first encounter with psychedelics was in 1974 in England, when I took LSD on impulse at a festival and was rewarded with 12 hours of bliss, revelation, scary challenges, time travel, and mystery. The experience was so powerful, however, that I felt afraid to seek it out again. Suppose the second time went wrong to the same heightened level as the first time went right. And over the next 30 years, I declined several opportunities for further trips. Until, that is, I found myself writing a book that I originally intended to be about the mystery of Stone Age cave art, but that ended up being about so much more than that. The book, published in 2005, was Supernatural: Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. And in 2002, during the preliminary stages of research, I came across the work of David Lewis Williams, professor of anthropology at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. Newly published that year, David's book, The Mind in the Cave: Consciousness and the Origins of Art, came as a revelation to me. It presented reams of evidence supported by cogent arguments to make the case that the characteristic features of cave art all around the world and the remarkable common themes in this art created by people who could have had no direct contact with one another are best explained if the artists, wherever and whenever they lived, had all experienced deeply altered states of consciousness. Specifically, those trance-like altered states sought out by shamans in tribal and hunter-gatherer cultures through the consumption of powerful psychedelic substances. In brief, David's neuropsychological theory of cave art proposes that shamans of the Stone Age used a variety of means, notably psychedelic plants and fungi, to enter trance states in which they experienced powerful visions. Later, returning to the normal, everyday state of consciousness, they remembered their visions and painted them on the walls of caves. I quickly discovered that the shamans of tribal and hunter-gatherer societies still extant in the world today all likewise embrace trance states, in many cases brought on by psychedelic plants and fungi. Many subsequently make paintings of their visions, and remarkably, this modern shamanic imagery, said to depict the spirit world and its inhabitants, is strikingly similar to the imagery of Stone Age cave art. Being a hands-on researcher, I knew that the time had come for me to renew my acquaintance with psychedelics. For my first research trips, I chose to travel to the Amazon rainforest of South America to sit down with shamans and drink with them the sacred visionary brew known as ayahuasca, the vine of souls or vine of the dead, in which the active ingredient is dimethyltryptamine, DMT, the most potent hallucinogen known to science. All in all, I had 11 ayahuasca sessions in the Amazon in 2003, enough to provide me with the authentic first-hand experiences I felt I needed to write my book. But since Supernatural was published in 2005, I have taken part in more than 70 further ayahuasca sessions, the four most recent of which, at time of writing, were held in Costa Rica in December 2019. My practice is not entirely consistent, but I try to make an ayahuasca pilgrimage once a year. On each occasion, wherever in the world I choose to go, joining with a small group of fellow seekers, usually in the range of 5 to 20 people, but sometimes, rarely, with as many as 100, to experience the brew in a ceremonial setting. Typically, these ceremonies are facilitated by Amazonian shamans or by Westerners who have undergone apprenticeships with Amazonian shamans. And with increasing frequency in the Western context, it is women, not men, who lead and guide the ceremonies. Drinking ayahuasca is hard work. The brew tastes obnoxious, a mixture of battery acid, rancid socks, raw sewage, and just a hint of chocolate, and routinely induces diarrhea, intense sweating, and projectile vomiting, followed by exhausting bouts of dry retching. The visions that accompany all this can sometimes be terrifying and sometimes deeply comforting. Extraordinary, swirling, scintillating geometric patterns provide an otherworldly backdrop, but the visions also routinely include encounters with intelligent entities, sometimes in human form, sometimes in animal form, and sometimes in the form of part animal, part human hybrids, known technically as therianthropes, from the Greek therion, meaning wild beast, and anthropos, meaning man. Despite having to brace myself for the discomfort of the experience, it is these visions that draw me back to ayahuasca year after year, this sense of gaining entry to a seamlessly convincing parallel universe and of being offered the opportunity to participate there in intriguing, meaningful, and sometimes life-changing encounters with seemingly otherworldly entities. Very commonly, these entities appear as serpents or as serpent-human hybrids, and Mother Ayahuasca herself, the entity believed by many to be the supernatural intelligence behind the brew, is frequently depicted in shamanic art as a serpent or as a serpent therianthrope. I have met her in this form many times. On one memorable occasion, for example, she appeared to me as a great boa constrictor 20 or 30 feet in length. She wrapped her coils gently around my body, laid her huge head on my shoulder, and gazed into my eyes for an infinity. She seemed very real to me, indeed more real than real, and her presence, despite the natural horror that we humans are supposed to have of serpents, was that of a deeply compassionate, utterly beautiful goddess who simply loved me for the longest while, during which she repeatedly beamed into my mind what felt like a telepathic message, a very simple, very basic message delivered nonetheless with astonishing, breathtaking power that I needed to be kinder and more nurturing to others. I emerged from the session with the clear knowledge that although I could not go back in time and correct past mistakes and past unkindnesses, I could choose never to repeat those mistakes and to be a kinder, more positive, compassionate, and constructive influence on the lives of others. I don't know whether Mother Ayahuasca is real in the way that we normally mean when we speak of real people or things, but what is interesting is that at the level of phenomenology, sources thoroughly documented and footnoted in my book Supernatural, many thousands of people have undergone encounters with her during ayahuasca sessions and have had their behavior and their outlook profoundly changed as a result. Those changes are real, even if materialist science would like to reduce the entity who inspires them to a mere epiphenomenon of disturbed brain activity. Very often this entity, who I repeat may or may not be real, but is experienced as real, gives us profound moral lessons in the depths of the ayahuasca journey. We may be shown episodes from our lives in which we've behaved unkindly or unjustly to others, or been mean-spirited and unloving, or have failed to live up to our own potential. And we will be shown these things with absolute clarity and transparency, with all illusions and excuses stripped away, so we are confronted with nothing more nor less than the cold, hard truth about ourselves. Such revelations can be very painful. Frequently, people cry during ayahuasca sessions because of them, but they bring insight and give us the chance to change our behavior in the future, to be more nurturing and less toxic, to be more considerate of others, and to be more aware than we were before of the incredible privilege the universe has given us by allowing us to be born in a human body, an opportunity for growth and improvement of the soul that we absolutely must not waste. Perhaps this is one of the reasons why ayahuasca has been so very successful in getting people off addictions to harmful hard drugs. For example, Dr. Jacques Mabit has for many years been offering heroin and cocaine addicts incredibly effective treatments with ayahuasca at his Takiwasi clinic in Tarapoto, Peru, where they might typically undergo 12 sessions with ayahuasca in the space of a month. A very high proportion of participants have such powerful revelations about the roots of their own problems and behavior during the sessions that they leave Takiwasi completely free of addiction, often without withdrawal symptoms, and never resume their habit. The success rate is far better than for any of the conventional Western treatments for drug addiction. Meanwhile, in Canada, Dr. Gabor Mate was offering phenomenally successful ayahuasca healing sessions to his drug-addicted patients before the Canadian government stepped in and stopped his work on the grounds that ayahuasca itself is an illegal drug. As Brian Murescu documents in the pages of The Immortality Key, however, Western science, so long recruited to justify the harsh punishments called for by the war on drugs, is increasingly recognizing the positive, life-changing benefits of psychedelics. In ridding individuals of post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, or in the case of those with terminal cancers, of their fear of death, the potential of psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, is presently being investigated at the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. And it is striking, as Brian reports, that about 75% of the research volunteers consistently rate their one and only dose of psilocybin as either the single most meaningful experience of their entire lives or among the top five. Likewise, I'm here to attest that in several, though by no means all of my many ayahuasca sessions, I have been blessed with experiences of such extraordinary power, yielding such penetrating insights, that I unhesitatingly rank them amongst the most meaningful in my life. Indeed, they have been so meaningful that they have changed my entire outlook on life and on the nature of reality. I'm still an atheist, and I still accept that those scientists who seek to reduce consciousness to matter may be right. But my experiences with ayahuasca have convinced me, as no amount of reading or studying or listening to lectures or sermons ever could, that materialist reductionism is a profound error, that to be alive and conscious at all is a mystery of enormous, immeasurable proportions, and in brief, as Shakespeare put it in Hamlet, that there are more things in heaven and earth than are presently dreamed of in our philosophy. When I first embraced atheism, I embraced the interlinked ideas that there is no transcendental meaning or purpose to life, that there's no heaven and no hell, and that when our bodies and brains die, it's absurd to imagine that some spiritual part of us, the soul, survives. After my ayahuasca experiences, I'm no longer so sure that logic and reason can effortlessly reduce us to our bodies in this way. On the contrary, I've seen much to convince me that although consciousness manifests in the body during life, it is neither made by the body, nor confined to the body, nor inevitably extinct on the death of the body. One outcome of this is that I no longer fear death as I once did. Rather, I regard its approach with curiosity and a sense of adventure. I think I can say, therefore, that my experiences with ayahuasca have been persuasive, perhaps in very much the same way that the experiences of pilgrims to the ancient Greek sanctuary of Eleusis were persuasive, and for very much the same reason, namely, as you will learn in the pages that follow, that a likely psychedelic brew, the kaikion, was drunk by participants at Eleusis, after which they experienced visions that banished all fear of death. The specific psychedelic compounds involved in ayahuasca are closely related to those in the kaikion, but by no means identical. the effects of the beatific visions and deeply meaningful experiences induced in both cases, however, appear to be quite remarkably the same. Ancient teachers. Throughout much of Western history, until the 4th century AD, when early primitive Christianity began to be systematically stamped out beneath the jackboots of the Roman Catholic Church, beatific visions were the primary recruitment tool of the enormously ancient and influential religion with no name that is the subject of the immortality key. This religion could shift and morph into multiple forms. The Eleusinian and Dionysian mysteries are among the examples Brian gives. And to these I would add the much older religion of the painted caves that I explored in Supernatural. But the common factor in every case was a psychedelic sacrament, sometimes food, sometimes drink, sometimes both, consumed by all participants. Primitive Christianity, as Brian convincingly argues here, started out around 2,000 years ago as merely the latest form or incarnation of this archaic religion, and at least in some cases, seems to have made use of bread and wine infused with psychedelic plants and fungi as its sacrament. At that time, because Christianity was persecuted under the Roman Empire until the reign of Constantine, AD 306 to 337, it was normal practice for its adherents to meet secretly in small groups to eat the bread and drink the wine of Holy Communion, and afterwards experience powerful and deeply meaningful beatific visions. And more often than not, these secret ceremonies of direct experiential communion with the divine were led by women, with men playing a secondary role. Then, from the second half of the 4th century AD onward, came the rise of Roman Catholicism, dominated by men, who took decisive steps to marginalize the role of women in the church and to remove the psychedelic elements from the sacrament, reducing Holy Communion to the empty symbolic act devoid of powerful experiential content that hundreds of millions of Christians continue to perform. My friend, the visionary artist Alex Gray, whose work has been much influenced by ayahuasca, describes the Old Testament story of the serpent, the forbidden fruit, and God's expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden as the first psychedelic slapdown. Pursuing that thought, Roman Catholicism's persecution of primitive Christians and the extirpation of their visionary communion wine might be described as the second psychedelic slapdown. And then in the 20th century, just as we seemed to be freeing ourselves from the loveless iron grip of the church and opening up to new spiritual possibilities, governments around the world waded in with the so-called war on drugs, the third psychedelic slapdown. Over the centuries, therefore, enormous and often deadly forces with the power, for example, to burn people at the stake or imprison them for decades, have repeatedly been unleashed to prevent people from experiencing direct contact with realms and realities other than the mundane. At the same time, however, even when it must have seemed that the religion with no name had been deleted completely from the human record, there were always, if I may extend the metaphor, multiple backup discs in the form of psychedelic plants and fungi growing all over the planet. There might be long gaps, lacunae of centuries even, but the moment would always come when certain curious individuals, either by accident or by design, would sample the plants and mushrooms that serve as the permanent hall of records of the religion with no name, thus setting in motion the experiences and subsequent processes of social organization that would ultimately allow it to be restored in full force. It is not an accident that the Mazatec shamans of southern Mexico refer to the psilocybe mushrooms used in their ceremonies as little teachers. And in a sense, that is what all psychedelic plants and fungi are, literally the ancient teachers of mankind. Whether we engage with ayahuasca, or with psilocybe mexicana, or with peyote, or with LSD, which is itself derived from the fungus ergot, we are dealing with the biological agents of the religion with no name, and with their numinous capacity to reawaken our spiritual appetites and potential. Brian tells us that he has never in his life had a psychedelic experience. nor is there any reason why he should, since the immortality key offers hard, factual data, an empirical argument, rather than a trip report. Moreover, the author's decision to remain a psychedelic virgin is, in my view, a wise strategic move, since it denies self-styled skeptics, of whom there are legions, any lazy ad hominem dismissal of this important book as the, quote, ravings of a, quote, druggie or other similar slurs. My own approach is different. I could not have written Supernatural without direct experience of psychedelics, and the resulting skeptical backlash has been large, sustained, and obvious. Indeed, to this day, more than 15 years after Supernatural was published, my engagement with psychedelics remains one of the main tools that skeptics use to ridicule and dismiss my work. I have no regrets. Despite my persisting undiluted atheism and the many years in which I distanced myself from anything and everything that looked like religious faith, the psychedelic ceremonies in which I have participated all around the world, ceremonies often led by women and held in secret like the communion of the primitive Christians, have reintroduced spirituality into my life. For this, I am deeply grateful. Graham Hancock.
Introduction. A New Reformation. I'm an atheist. I don't believe there is a God, she affirms. But then I began to feel this love, just overwhelming, all-encompassing love. There's a long silence. And the way I describe it is being bathed in God's love, she goes on, her voice cracking, because I find no other way to describe it. I felt that I belonged, that I was part of everything and had the right to be here. How else do I describe it? Maybe what your mother's love felt like when you were a baby. This feeling of love was suffusing the entire experience. I'm talking with Dinah Baser, New Yorker, grandmother, survivor, and unrepentant non-believer. She was diagnosed with mixed cell ovarian cancer in 2010 at the age of 63. Ordinarily, more than half the women in Dinah's position don't outlive the dreaded 5-year window past their diagnosis. But Dinah was one of the lucky ones. She caught her tumor early at stage 1C, ensuring much better odds of winning the battle. After 6 rounds of chemotherapy and 2 years of follow-up appointments, the cancer was in remission, and Dinah should have been feeling optimistic. But she couldn't shake her paralyzing fear of the disease that is never cured, only contained, and could always return with a vengeance. In 2012, Dinah confessed her existential crisis to one of the nurses from the Perlmutter Cancer Center at New York University during a routine checkup. It was suggested she enroll in a first-of-its-kind study that their psychiatric team was conducting with Johns Hopkins University. On its face, the researchers were trying to determine if psilocybin, the active compound in magic mushrooms, could ease depression and anxiety in cancer patients. According to the findings of the randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial released in the respected Journal of Psychopharmacology in November 2016, the vast majority found clinical relief, with 87% of NYU's 29 volunteers reporting increased life satisfaction or well-being for months afterward. Like Dinah, a full 70% rated their one and only dose of psilocybin as either the most meaningful experience of their entire lives or among the top 5. The numbers were consistent with the 51 volunteers from the Hopkins study, the results of which were published simultaneously. Altogether, 80 tormented people dove into the unknown. Most left with a new lease on life, forever changed. The outcome is characterized as unprecedented within the field of psychiatry. While the new batch of data was eye-catching from a therapeutic perspective, the researchers weren't necessarily looking for the next Prozac or Xanax. There's not much money in a single-dose wonder drug. The pharmaceutical industry tends to prefer long-term users who get hooked on a steady regimen of renewable prescriptions. Instead, the NYU team had joined their colleagues at Hopkins on the hunt for something far more valuable. The real question wasn't whether psychedelics might work for those confronting death, but why? and the initial answers had already led the scientists down a rather unscientific path, trespassing into corridors of the mind that once interested students of religion alone. A decade earlier, in 2006, the Hopkins team completed the first psilocybin project since the 1970s, when research into the forbidden substance became largely impossible during the war on drugs. Under tightly controlled conditions, the psilocybin unleashed a profound, mystical experience that seemed to anchor the lasting emotional and psychological benefits recorded by the 36 volunteers. They had no life-threatening illness and were otherwise free of the debilitating angst that just consumed Dinah. But these early results were shockingly similar to the 2016 collaboration with NYU. One-third of the participants rated their experience as the most spiritually significant of their lives, comparing it to the birth of a child or the death of a parent. Two-thirds placed it among the top five. When friends, family, and coworkers were interviewed, they confirmed the remarkable transformations in the volunteers' mood and behavior for months, even years, following their single dose. From that moment on, Dr. Roland Griffiths upended his career to focus almost exclusively on psilocybin, creating what is now called the Johns Hopkins Psychedelic Research Unit. More than 360 volunteers and 50 peer-reviewed publications later, he's ready to call a spade a spade. In his 2016 TED Talk, Griffiths said the drug-induced ecstasy he routinely witnesses in the laboratory is virtually identical to that reported by natural-born prophets and visionaries throughout human history. The underlying experience itself, whether activated by psilocybin or some spontaneous internal flood of neurotransmitters, must be biologically normal. If we are essentially wired for mystical experience, it raises the intriguing prospect that, under the right mindset and environment, any curious soul can be instantly converted into a religious savant. Griffith's colleague, Dr. William Richards, has been testing that hypothesis since the 1960s, when he co-developed the very scale to measure these peak states of consciousness, the Mystical Experience Questionnaire. Richards himself holds the dubious distinction of administering the final dose of psilocybin in 1977 at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, the last legal refuge for this research before an extended hiatus. Together with Griffiths, he was the first to get the ball rolling again in the early 2000s, once the federal government was persuaded by the high standards of scholarly competence at Hopkins, one of the top medical schools in the country. In his 2015 book, Sacred Knowledge, Psychedelics and Religious Experiences, Richards maps out the essential features of the perfect psilocybin journey, transcending time and space, intuitively sensing the unity and sacredness of all things, accessing knowledge that is normally not available. Oftentimes, there is a merging of the everyday personality with a larger, more fundamental whole. Words fail to capture the unsinkable conviction that the experiencer has somehow glimpsed the ultimate nature of reality, an insight that seems blatantly obvious at the time, and is usually accompanied by intense feelings of joy, tranquility, exaltation, and awe. On the ineffability scale, Dinah is certainly no exception. I'm wondering why an avowed atheist would appeal to God to describe the infinite love that bathed her as the psilocybin supercharged her biochemistry. Why not the love of the universe, or the love of the cosmos, or the love of nature, I ask? Because God is as good as the universe, and the cosmos, and nature. These are all things we really don't know. I've always thought heaven and hell were absurd ideas. I am not interested in mysticism at all. I tend to think of it as a bunch of baloney. And I don't think there's any meaning to life. But it doesn't matter to me, because my own experience is all I have. I've had very religious people ask me, "You don't believe in God?" And I say, "No, I believe in love." And I can still feel it sometimes. Even now, 7 years later? Oh, yes. But words don't always fail. Dinah can dredge up poignant specifics about the visions, now indelibly tattooed on her psyche, that unfolded during the psilocybin session in 2012. Lying comfortably on a couch, with her eyes under a sleep shade and headphones pumping a soothing mix of classical and instrumental music, she tackled the therapeutic portion of her six-hour journey in pretty short order. In her mind's eye, Dinah saw what she immediately recognized as her fear and anxiety, a big, black lump like coal under my ribcage on the left-hand side, which was not where the cancer was. It was not my cancer. Enraged, she yelled some colorful language at the inky intruder like a proper New Yorker, and in an instant it was gone. For good. The nasty part out of the way, Dinah had nothing left to do but enjoy the playlist that had been skillfully cobbled together by the NYU team. So I just drifted away. I was living in the music like a river. That's when the love of God entered Dinah's life, staying with her for the remaining hours on the couch and the many years since. But something else happened too, and the researchers believe it holds the key to the whole experience. The sequence is tricky to verbalize. Dinah is keen that I not misquote her by writing something as sentimental and cliched as being at one with the universe. So she describes a process in which there was a dissolution of the self and a melting away of barriers. She remembers the moment when concepts like internal and external no longer held true. I'm not just standing there, looking out at the world anymore. I'm part of the world. After a lengthy pause, while she harvests the right phrase, Dinah refers to this fleeting moment as a state of pure being. She recalls taking several deep breaths, exhaling with force, just to hear the air escape her chest. She needed to prove that her physical body was still there, that it still existed somewhere in time and space. The source of her awareness, once so easy to locate, was suddenly everywhere and nowhere at once. And then it all made sense. In that unsettling, parallel reality, waiting effortlessly to the violins, Dinah arrived at the realization that birth and death actually don't have any meaning. When forced to clarify, she adds, "It's more of a state of always being." Always being? Always being. So being now and always. There's no beginning or end. Every moment is an eternity of its own. A poetic breakthrough from a skeptic. That's precisely what Dinah's guide, Dr. Anthony Bossis, was hoping for. As a professor with NYU's Department of Psychiatry and its director of palliative care research for the psilocybin study, the clinical psychologist's professional specialty is the existential, spiritual, and psychological distress that preys on so many Americans as they approach death. Recent statistics show that depression is up 26% for those at the end of life. In a culture that generally avoids the topic, subcontracting the gritty details over to a ballooning hospice care industry, Bossis believes we simply don't end well in this country. Instead of a bad death marked by needless suffering, he sees psilocybin as a meaning-making medicine with enormous potential, not just for the dying, but for everybody. The historic partnership with Hopkins gave Bossis a front-row seat to the cutting-edge research of Roland Griffiths and William Richards that had fascinated him for years. His unforgettable sessions with Dinah and dozens of other volunteers brought home the real-world consequences of the seemingly unreal experience at the mystical core of these psilocybin trials. For Bossis, Dinah is the ultimate example of the sustained positive impact that can be triggered by an unexpected rendezvous with God's love, even for an atheist. While language can never do justice to what Dinah experienced, she undoubtedly made contact with what Bossis calls a timeless dimension that fosters non-attachment to all the pain, despair, and stress of being human, allowing a connection to something more enduring within. In a personal email, Bossis explained why such an irrational event can reliably generate so much meaning for those on the verge of death. Participants in our study often describe this experience with the newfound knowledge that consciousness survives bodily death, that we are not only our bodies, which is a profound gift to a person with a body that is failing and will soon stop functioning due to advanced disease. It has been described as a transcendence of past, present, future, timelessness in the moment. I've heard participants speak about feeling outside of time. The insight that we are not bound by the material world is a powerful one. It is psychologically, existentially, and spiritually liberating. In order to identify with that grander, more expansive aspect of themselves, the part that might never die in Dinah's state of always being, a shedding of the familiar has to occur. Surrendering the physical body and losing all sense of time and space can feel disorienting, like a little death all in itself. As if a foreshadow of what's to come, Bossis writes, some of the volunteers say, this is what death will be like. This is death. William Richards has been documenting the same phenomenon since the 1960s, using the identical words as Dinah to describe the transition into mystical realms of consciousness as melting or dissolving, even as being deliciously seduced by a divine lover. In Sacred Knowledge, Psychedelics and Religious Experiences, he further adds, the mind may undergo one or more intense experiences of death and rebirth, and awareness of the ego, that is, that part of your mind that functions with your name in everyday life, may ebb and flow. Similarly, awareness of the body lying on the couch may come and go as one might expect to experience in a state of deep trance. This threshold between the personal, that is, the everyday self, and the transpersonal, that is, more fundamental or universal dimensions of consciousness, is conceptualized by different people in different ways. Most commonly, the term death is employed as the ego, everyday self, feels that it is quite literally dying. Though one may have read that others have reported subsequent immersion in the eternal and experiences of being reborn and returning to everyday existence afterward, in the moment, imminence of death may feel acutely, and for some terrifyingly, real. And right there, plain as can be, is the stated goal of every mystic or saint who has ever tried to put any of the world's religions to the ultimate test. To die before you die. Or rather, to psychologically maim the ego, even for a brief instant, in order to be initiated into an understanding of what lies beneath all the thoughts, feelings, and memories that have gone into the lifetime construction of our false, or at the very least, incomplete, sense of self. The little ego, Latin for I, that seems so firmly in control, is just an elaborate illusion, and only half the story, as brilliantly narrated by the Harvard-trained neuroanatomist Jill Bolte Taylor in her 2008 book, My Stroke of Insight. With minute attention to every detail, Bolte Taylor recounts the cerebral hemorrhage she suffered in 1996, when the rupture of a blood vessel in a very strategic area of her left hemisphere sent all calculating intelligence out the window. The half of her brain responsible for categorizing and organizing sensory input simply went offline. Suddenly, there was no more brain chatter, no dialogue with her inner voice, that advisor that helps us navigate the external world by comparing incoming data from the five senses to past experiences and running split-second algorithms to determine the best course of future action. It's the kind of linear, rational thinking that reminds us to restock the refrigerator or put gas in the car before it's too late. It prompts us into the bathroom when nature calls, leaving infants and toddlers to soil their diapers. Before the ego has fully formed, this mental back and forth takes a few years to mature and lock in place. But once it does, the left hemisphere assumes daily command, forcing the right hemisphere's more immediate awareness of the present moment into the shadows of forgotten childhood. During Bolte Taylor's stroke, it wasn't about what happened before or what comes next, but what's happening now. The same timeless now that awed Dinah with its endlessness. Every moment is an eternity of its own. Could this be how newborns see the world before they even realize they're separate beings, independent of their mothers? Every parent gets a kick out of that developmental milestone when babies finally realize they have arms, staring in disbelief at the hands attached to their alien limbs. Whoa, I'm a weird-looking thing, Bolte Taylor recalls reacting to her body during the initial stages of the stroke while she mounted the cardio glide for her morning exercise routine. Like a great whale gliding through a sea of silent euphoria, the scientist felt no worry, no concern, and no grief whatsoever. And with total contentment, she prepared to die. But like Dinah and the hundreds of psilocybin volunteers ushered through a harrowing ego death in recent years, Bolte Taylor survived, reborn with fresh eyes and childlike wonder into the half of her brain that went missing with the pacifier. She calls it the deep inner peace circuitry of the right hemisphere. Once it was reactivated, she could find solace in that sea of silent euphoria throughout the 8 years it took to fully recover from the stroke. Similarly, Dinah tells me she can relive the sensation of being bathed in God's love if she's just able to slow down. She doesn't meditate as often as she'd like, but whenever she does, that divine love wells up. The NYU playlist can trigger it too. Bosses gave her a copy after the psilocybin session, which Dinah particularly enjoys listening to on Thanksgiving. Whatever kind of God this is, it has nothing to do with tired doctrine or stale dogma. It's a felt presence that never judges, never condemns, never demands anything in return. Certainly not blind belief. When I visited William Richards at his oasis of a home outside Baltimore in the early summer of 2018, he distilled his decades worth of research like a Zen master. Once you've plunged into the ocean, does it really matter whether or not you believe in water? Dinah might not have been looking for it, but what she got was a genuine religious experience, and it's the kind of experience that just might speak to the rising tide of seekers who could spend a lifetime in the church, temple, or mosque and never once feel the rapture that is consistently delivered in a single afternoon at Hopkins and NYU. Over 1 billion people across the planet are now religiously unaffiliated, including 1 in 5 Americans and Europeans and almost half the British public. The unchurching of America is being driven especially by the 40% of millennials who don't identify with any faith whatsoever. That figure is more than double what it was a generation ago. The God now rejected by America's largest generation, 73 million people, is not the God of Dinah Baser. A God that you can actually experience in a direct and personal way is a God that makes sense. A God that erases depression and anxiety like a cosmic surgeon, obliterates the fear of death, and sends a shockwave of love through your fragile heart is a God that lives in high definition, and a God that could hardly be expected to start a war against non-believers. More troubling is the God of organized religion and his army of spokesmen, those priests, rabbis, and imams who stand between superficial definitions of heaven and a common-sense public who have every right to demand proof. When the answer to their doubts is condescending moralism contrived from an outdated and impenetrable holy book, it's time to cut out the middleman in the private search for transcendence. The result is the 27% of all Americans fueling the spiritual but not religious, SBNR, phenomenon. It has been called the most important religious development of our time because the trend is clear and will only surge in the years to come. With unprecedented access to the teachings of the world's faiths, we are living in an age when the rallying cry of the SBNRs has never been more achievable. To be the student and beneficiary of all traditions and the slave to none. If there's a spiritual crisis in the West, it's because the defenders of the three great monotheistic faiths have forgotten their roots. When Yahweh appeared to Moses in a burning bush, it was a terrifying ordeal. The emancipator of the Israelites feared for his life and shielded his eyes from the God who would later warn in Exodus 33:20, "You cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live." Christianity's greatest missionary, St. Paul, was struck blind for 3 days on the road to Damascus by a flash of heaven-sent light, followed by an auditory hallucination of Jesus. Thereafter, Paul would claim continued supernatural communication with the Son of God. The entire Quran was dictated to Muhammad, word for word, by the angel Gabriel, who revealed Islam's scripture in a series of trances. One of Muhammad's earliest biographers, Ibn Ishaq, records the belief of family friends that the young prophet suffered a stroke. Modern scholars say he was prone to ecstatic seizures. "There is no other way to start a religion," says the Benedictine monk Brother David Steindl-Rasht. "Every religion has its mystical core. The challenge is to find access to it and to live in its power." In what he calls the centuries-long tension between the mystical and the religious establishment, The technicians who yearned for real experience are always butting heads with the authorities who are just trying to keep the house in working order. According to Brother David, time has an influence on the system. The pipes tend to get rusty and start to leak, or they get clogged up. The flow from the source slows down to a trickle. When that happens, the experience of Dinah's God recedes into the mists of history. The written word that tries to capture the original encounter inevitably replaces the personal experience of awe, so that live doctrine fossilizes into dogmatism, and the ethics and morality that attempt to translate mystical communion into practical living are reduced to moralism. But despite the dogmatism and moralism that inevitably muck up the system, the mystics have always come along with an embarrassing reminder for the self-appointed enforcers of the establishment's rules and regulations. When it comes to God, a word rarely used by the mystics, there is total unanimity on one crucial issue of paramount importance. God does not reside in a holy book. Whether it's the Bible or the Quran, the mystics have never found God by reading about God. There is no class, no lecture, no homily that will ever bring you closer to God, because there is, in fact, absolutely nothing you could ever learn about God. For the mystics, the only way to know God is to experience God, and the only way to experience God is to unlearn everything the ego has been trying so vigorously to manufacture since our infancy. In order to stop wetting the bed and become productive members of society, that deep inner peace circuitry of the right hemisphere has been sidelined along the way. To bring it back online, say the mystics, the simplest and most effective method is to die before you die. It's why the Sufis, the mystics of Islam, have been called the impatient ones. Rather than wait until their actual death, the spiritual experts of the world's second largest religion rank one task more urgent than any other: recovering an awareness of one's full identity in this lifetime. The 12th century Persian pharmacist Attar once said, "So long as we do not die to ourselves, and so long as we are identified with someone or something, we shall never be free." His protege, Rumi, the Sufi master and, in recent years, best-selling poet in America, was in total agreement. If you could get rid of yourself just once, the secret of secrets would open to you. The face of the unknown, hidden beyond the universe, would appear on the mirror of your perception. It's why a fundamental concept for the Kabbalists, the mystics of Judaism, is ayin, nothingness. When a man attains to the stage of self-annihilation, he can thus be said to have reached the world of the divine nothingness. Emptied of selfhood, his soul has now become attached to the true reality. Rabbi Lawrence Kushner has written extensively about the process that he calls a rehearsal for our moment of transition. Just as the death of each creature is in turn a rehearsal for the death of a species and a galaxy and a cosmos, the great rhythm of going out and returning. Now, this kind of death is not an end, but only the beginning of a transformation that will generate a rebirth. You cannot be reborn until you are willing to die. It's why the German theologian Meister Eckhart, the mystic par excellence of medieval Christianity, put so much emphasis on the self-effacement that is the one condition precedent to finding God. If you could not yourself for an instant, indeed I say less than an instant, you would possess all. Eckhart describes the nullification of the ego as a process of unlearning, in which the soul must lose her being and her life in something like Bolte Taylor's sea of silent euphoria. We cannot serve this word better than in stillness and silence. There we can hear it, and there too we will understand it aright, in the unknowing. To him who knows nothing, it appears and reveals itself. To this day, all visitors to St. Paul's Monastery on Mount Athos in Greece, one of the most important sites in Orthodox spirituality, will come face to face with a beautiful Greek saying mounted on the wall of the reception area: "If you die before you die, you won't die when you die." Notice the complete absence of the word God in the preceding quotations. Something tells me that if the mystics were in charge of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the world would be a very different place. where even a pragmatist like Dinah might find herself agreeing with the old adage about mysticism. Atheists and mystics both essentially believe in nothing. The only difference is that mystics spell it with a capital N. And if enough consenting, healthy adults could experience what Dinah experienced with proper preparation and guidance, even once in their lives, we just might have a new reformation on our hands. That's what British philosopher Aldous Huxley predicted back in the 1950s, in the wake of his sublime experience with mescaline, peyote's visionary compound. In The Doors of Perception from 1954, Huxley recorded his own taste of egolessness, resulting in the epiphany that all is in all, that all is actually each. His mescaline-occasioned mystical experience was described as the closest a finite mind can ever come to perceiving everything that is happening everywhere in the universe. Decades ahead of the unchurching of America and most of Europe, Huxley spotted an antidote to the 90 minutes of boredom that was already plaguing the average Sunday churchgoer. In a later opinion published in the Saturday Evening Post in 1958, he foresaw a future where psychedelics might turn organized religion into a thing of the past. My own belief is that, though they may start by being something of an embarrassment, these new mind changers will tend in the long run to deepen the spiritual life of the communities in which they are available. That famous revival of religion, about which so many people have been talking for so long, will not come about as the result of evangelistic mass meetings or the television appearances of photogenic clergymen. It will come about as the result of biochemical discoveries that will make it possible for large numbers of men and women to achieve a radical self-transcendence and a deeper understanding of the nature of things. And this revival of religion will be at the same time a revolution. From being an activity mainly concerned with symbols, religion will be transformed into an activity concerned mainly with experience and intuition and everyday mysticism, underlying and giving significance to everyday rationality, everyday tasks and duties, everyday human relationships. 60 years later, however, the religious establishment still generally shares the opinion of the federal government that mescaline, psilocybin, and their psychedelic sisters should remain entirely off-limits. Throughout history, the mystics have been persecuted and sometimes executed for a reason. Nothing could be more alarming to the ecclesiastical hierarchy, the philosopher Alan Watts once observed, than a popular outbreak of mysticism, for this might well amount to setting up a democracy in the kingdom of heaven. In the United States, these compounds are still classified as Schedule I drugs under the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, which means they have no currently accepted medical use and demonstrate a high potential for abuse. This, despite the fact that the elimination of Dinah's anxiety in 2012 approaches something of a medical miracle and that she hasn't touched psilocybin since. Regardless of the federal government's position, the steady march of science is winning converts at the local level, where the earliest buds of the psychedelic reformation are beginning to flower. In May 2019, Denver became the very first city in the country to decriminalize the use and possession of magic mushrooms. Oakland and Santa Cruz soon followed in California, with their city councils extending the treatment to all naturally occurring psychedelic plants and fungi. As the first to legalize statewide cannabis for personal use in 2012, Colorado is already home to the International Church of Cannabis, which opened its doors in 2017. The first psychedelic churches will inevitably be next. Is this an artificial get-God-quick scheme? Or, as Huxley predicted, are we witnessing the birth of a genuine reformation, with the practical mystics of the 21st century leading the charge? For this movement to have any substance or merit, Huxley's vision must be based on rock-solid historical precedent. After all, the Reformation of the 16th century had some serious scholarship behind it. Martin Luther's fascination with the original Greek language of the New Testament was a product of the humanism that had engulfed Renaissance Europe. The humanist chief motto was ad fontes, back to the source in Latin, which meant a return to the intellectual brilliance of the Greek and Roman ancestors, the midwives of the Christian faith. Luther based his German translation of the Bible on the Greek edition published in 1516 by the Dutch humanist Erasmus, who had meticulously compared the original New Testament with as many Latin manuscripts as he could find, in order to root out any discrepancies with the Greek source material. It has been said that Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. The rediscovery of Christianity's true origins and its real meaning being the primary motivation of the entire Reformation. When Huxley wrote of a revival of religion in 1958, that's precisely what he had in mind as well. Except he wasn't looking to the New Testament. He was looking beyond the book, back to the original practices of the Paleo-Christians that surrounded the New Testament. In the doors of perception, he entered sacrilegious waters. In the early centuries of Christianity, many pagan rites and festivals were baptized, so to say, and made to serve the purposes of the church. Without getting into the specifics of a contentious debate, Huxley characterized the pre-Christian ceremonies as soul-satisfying expressions of fundamental urges that were incorporated into the fabric of the new religion. Strangely, he didn't further pursue the so-called pagan continuity hypothesis, the theory that Christianity didn't magically appear from one day to the next, but inherited pagan elements from the Greco-Roman cults of the ancient Mediterranean world. It wasn't a new theory by any means. The debate between secular and ecclesiastical scholars over the church's origins stretches back to the 19th century. In 1950, another Martin Luther, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., would weigh in with an essay titled, "The Influence of the Mystery Religions on Christianity." There was a time when people could discuss such things and respectfully disagree with civility. In 1954, the only thing Huxley added was a psychedelic twist. By calling the foundations of Christianity into question, Huxley was prophesying not only the death of organized religion, but a return to its mystical roots and a revival of something that, if the pieces could just be fit together, would not only rewrite the origins of Christianity, but Western civilization at large. The task was too daunting for the British philosopher, however, and better left to the classicists, the specialists in Greek and Latin like Erasmus and Martin Luther, who would carry the torch in the years to come. Only they had the ad fontes training to decipher what Houston Smith, author of The World's Religions and perhaps the preeminent religious scholar of the 20th century, would later refer to as the best-kept secret in history. To this day, it remains the greatest unsolved mystery of the ancient past, centuries of scholars working round the clock on the avid hunt for answers. What was the original sacrament of Western civilization? And did it somehow sneak its way into the primitive rites of Christianity? If the experts ever turn up new information on the real reason why the universe of Greek-speaking pagans became the founding generations of Christianity, turning a Jewish healer from Galilee into the most famous human being who ever lived, it promises the Reformation to end all reformations, because the mystical core, the ecstatic source, and the true lifeblood of the biggest religion the world has ever known will have finally been exposed. Like this book, the pagan continuity hypothesis with a psychedelic twist is divided into two very simple questions. One, before the rise of Christianity, did the ancient Greeks consume a secret psychedelic sacrament during their most famous and well-attended religious rituals? Two, did the ancient Greeks pass a version of their sacrament along to the earliest Greek-speaking Christians, for whom the original Holy Communion or Eucharist was in fact a psychedelic Eucharist? If the answer to the first question is yes, and the roots of Western civilization were soaked in mind-altering drugs, then the recent experiments at Hopkins and NYU would appear to be anything but a modern fad. Indeed, it would force a massive reassessment of our current relationship with naturally occurring substances that were not only sacred, but indispensable to the architects of democracy and the world as we know it. If the answer to both questions is yes, then the new Reformation is as well-grounded and historically oriented as Martin Luther's Reformation, and it becomes an immediate reality for tens of millions of SBNRs and religiously disillusioned. But more pressingly, today's 2.42 billion Christians, almost one-third of the global population, will have to decide whether they will continue sipping from a placebo amid 90 minutes of boredom or join the revolution that just might rescue a dying faith and a civilization on the edge of extinction. 2,000 years in the making, the crisis is real, and the stakes couldn't be higher. Unfortunately, the war for the soul of Western civilization has been neatly tucked away in dry academic journals and arcane conferences where none of the learned infighting filters down to the general public. A little translation would go a long way, but just when they're needed most, all the interpreters seem to be disappearing, keeping all the controversy behind closed doors. And until now, leaving this book unwritten. The classics are dying, and dying fast. Or maybe they're already dead. Who better than two very disgruntled Stanford-educated professors to assess the situation? A mock epic struggle of nocturnal creatures croaking and scratching at each other for their tiny lily pad on an evaporating pond. Such was the judgment rendered in 2001 in Who Killed Homer? The Demise of Classical Education and the Recovery of Greek Wisdom. In their bitter indictment of academia, Victor David Hansen and John Robert Heath eulogize the imminent death of our Greek intellectual heritage. They lay the blame squarely on spineless administrators and egg-headed inbred classics departments. On the one hand, there's the fear of leaving today's students unequipped with the kind of practical skills needed in a 21st century economy. What college or university can honestly afford to push majors in dead languages? Once the school gets a reputation for graduating unemployed deadbeats, the jig is up. On the other hand, there are the classicists themselves. That vast gulf between the vitality of the Greeks and the timidity of those who are responsible for preserving the Greeks, between the clarity and exuberance of the former and the obscurity and dullness of the latter. A brutal combination. Between the bureaucrats and the bookworms, our institutions of higher learning have been sucked dry of the very thing that created them in the first place, Latin and Greek. For most of Western history, studying these ancient languages was the only thing you could do at a university. Since the Renaissance, higher education has largely been synonymous with fluency in the classics. Just think of the cult of antiquity fostered by the first generations of Americans. John Adams' opinion that Athens and Rome had done more honor to our species, humanity, than all the rest was far from unique in the late 18th century. The principal drafter of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, looked to classical literature as the ultimate source of both delight and instruction. Historian Carl Richard explains that the grammar in grammar school actually refers to Greek and Latin grammar. The prevailing opinion of the time was that the classroom should be reserved for serious academic subjects like classical languages, rather than wasted on things the child could easily learn at home, like English grammar. In the ensuing years, however, newer utilitarian subjects slipped into the curriculum for the very first time. The physical sciences, modern languages, history, and geography. Noah Webster, the father of American scholarship and education, and the guy behind the famous dictionary, wanted to get down to brass tacks. What advantage does a merchant, a mechanic, a farmer, derive from an acquaintance with Greek and Roman tongues? After World War II, many universities dropped Greek from the core curriculum altogether, making it possible to graduate with zero knowledge of Western civilization's mother tongue. You can hear Hansen and Heath reminiscing about the glory days, bracing for the inevitable. As long as literacy, polished written and oral expression, familiarity with politics and social systems, and a common set of unchanging ethical presumptions were the chief goals of a liberal arts education, as long as education itself demanded some memorization and structure from the student, classics would not vanish, even if enrollments in the classical languages took their customarily cyclical decline. The study of classics had always been at the center of Western education, had always risen to the challenge, answering the charges of irrelevancy and practicality and pagan-inspired iniquity. The university itself, remember, was a Greek idea. Its entire structure, nomenclature, and operation Greco-Roman to the core. 20th century minds as diverse as T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, Picasso, and Winston Churchill proved the value of classics for knowledge, expression, and eloquence, for radicals and reactionaries alike. Then, according to the Stanford duo, came the self-righteous 1960s. The same countercultural movement that gave rise to anti-war protests, classic rock, and psychedelics, also put enormous pressure on an antiquated model of education, one well beyond its expiration date. Dead languages just didn't fit the times, with personal growth and self-indulgence leading more students to the arts or social sciences like politics, economics, and psychology, and less to the ancient past. Authority and tradition were to be questioned at all costs. Nobody wanted to study useless grammar and syntax with a bunch of old white World War I vets. If the Vatican itself was about to remove Latin from the Mass, for God's sake, there was no hope for the American university. And that's how, after more than 2,500 years, Homer finally went the way of the typewriter. In recent years, enrollments in ancient Greek have plummeted. This is no customarily cyclical decline. As it turns out, Hansen and Heath were on point. They saw the writing on the wall and accurately predicted it back in 2001. The Greeks, unfamiliar to the general public at large, are also now dead in the university itself. Today, classics embraces a body of knowledge and a way of looking at the world that are virtually unrecognized, an almost extinct species, even in its own precious habitat, the academic department. We classicists are the dodo birds of academia. When we retire or die, our positions are either eliminated or replaced with temporary and part-time help. I was one of the lucky ones, I guess. I got to see the rare species up close and personal, before it took a final, well-deserved bow. Founded in 1851, St. Joe's Prep was no place for a wise-ass from the blue-collar enclave of Northeast Philadelphia, whose only familiarity with such institutions came from watching Dead Poets Society and School Ties. I sometimes curse the chance scholarship that ushered me into the fanciest all-boys high school in the city, but there were two things in the Jesuit playbook that quickly turned me into a bona fide member of the inner circle: Latin and Greek. It was love at first sight. 4 years later, absolutely convinced that I was destined to be a classics professor or a priest, I was recruited by Brown University to continue my useless study of the ancient world. As the first person in my family to attend college, I decided to blow the opportunity on dead languages, picking up Sanskrit along the way. For 4 more years, I traveled back in time straight to the source, ad fontes, with nothing lost in translation, direct from the minds of the people who birthed Western civilization and penned the New Testament. My classes in the historic McFarland House on College Hill rarely saw more than 5 students, and yet it never once occurred to me that I was woefully unprepared for life in the real world. Not until I heard the graduate students grumbling about the job market and mourning the grim reality summed up by Hansen and Heath. So many PhDs in classics, so little employment. Because there are almost no students, because there is really no interest in the Greeks in or out of the university. Chock full of useless knowledge and no marketable skills, I did the only other thing I was qualified for at that point. I joined the legal profession. After graduating law school and passing the New York bar, I tried to settle into my new life on Wall Street at Milbank, Tweed, Hadley & McCloy. Hoping I'd actually learn something about international corporate finance, the partners made me subscribe to The Economist. In the summer of 2007, I randomly plucked an issue from the growing pile of unread magazines in the corner of my office. The title of the article that would forever change my life smacked me in the face: The God Pill. It was a brief write-up of the very first psilocybin experiment at Hopkins. I'll never forget the moment when I read that statistic about 2/3 of volunteers counting their single dose of the drug among the most meaningful experiences of their entire lives. An ethnomycologist by the name of R. Gordon Wasson was mentioned in the first line of the article, the inspiration behind the opening salvo of the psychedelic renaissance that would culminate in the 50 peer-reviewed papers from the Johns Hopkins Psychedelic Research Unit. I instantly remembered a book titled The Road to Eleusis, first published in 1978. I'd read it at Brown, in addition to every other book in the John D. Rockefeller Jr. Library that had anything to do with ancient Greek religion. Together with co-authors Albert Hofmann and Carl Ruck, Wasson claimed a potent psychedelic was behind the life-changing vision universally witnessed over the millennia by initiates in Eleusis, the Greek spiritual capital, about 13 miles northwest of Athens. From Boston University, Ruck would later suggest that Christianity itself was similarly founded on drugs. It was certainly an unconventional line of thought. At the time, however, there was very little scholarship specifically dedicated to drug use in ancient Greece or early Christianity, With no way to dig deeper, that's where I had to leave the idea for many years, until William Richards and Roland Griffiths, the chief researchers at Hopkins, brought it back on my radar in the most unexpected way possible, through the laboratory. I logged straight on to my new Amazon account and used my law firm salary to order everything Wasson, Hoffman, or Ruck had ever written. I then spent the next 12 years researching this book, as a 30-year-old hypothesis became a 40-year-old hypothesis to which no one paid any attention. To this day, I have never personally experimented with psychedelics, in the conscious effort to let the objective evidence guide the investigation that has consumed my adult life. While the Hopkins and NYU data was compelling from a circumstantial perspective, hard evidence linking the ancient Greeks or Paleo-Christians to a psychedelic sacrament was pretty elusive. So I kept my nose to the grindstone on nights and weekends when I wasn't practicing law, as additional data started coming in from other scientific disciplines like archaeobotany and archaeochemistry, which have now proven the existence of hallucinogenic beer and wine in the ancient Mediterranean, and its possible consumption for ritual purposes. Finally, 60 years